Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It is 4 minutes after the hour, and welcome to the show. It is Tuesday, October 17th. So glad you're with us this morning. I want to start with a passage from Hebrews chapter 4, verse 12. It says, "For the word of God is alive and active, sharper than any double-edged sword. It penetrates even to dividing soul and spirit, joints and marrow. It judges the thoughts and attitudes of the heart." I wanted to read that verse, and then I want to read this one. This is out of Psalm 25. Verses 14 and 15, it says, "The Lord confides in those who fear him." I don't know if I've probably read that before, but that really struck me this morning. The Lord confides in those who fear him. This is why I love the fact that the Word of God is alive and active, sharper than any double-edged sword. I know I've read that before, but for some reason it struck me this morning like, whoa. It says, "He makes his covenant known to them. My eyes are ever on the Lord, for only he will release my feet from the snare." What a great promise. I just love the fact that the Lord confides in those who fear him. All right, I've got Rob Bluey coming up in just a few minutes, my Washington, D.C. correspondent. Like I've got correspondents, but I do. I'm just calling Rob that. And I'm reading here that President Trump thinks a short-term fix on health care is on the horizon, followed by a long-term fix. Speaking at the White House yesterday, Trump said Obamacare is dead and should not even be mentioned anymore. The president recently added billions of dollars in federal subsidies to insurance companies. The subsidies have been aimed at helping lower-income people afford health insurance. Here's something that I thought was interesting. Apple is taking a look at getting into health care. According to a CNBC report, the tech company came very close to recently to buying medical clinic startup Crossover Health. Crossover highlights its digital features, such as mobile apps that allow people to make same-day appointments. Apple also reportedly approached the nationwide primary medical care group One Medical, which makes extensive use of mobile apps. So you can go to maybe Apple's getting into healthcare. How weird is that? All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, Rob Bluey is with us. Be back in a minute. Thanks for being with us. Good morning. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Rob Bluey is the editor of the Daily Signal and also with the Heritage Foundation. He is always great, and he's never less than sensational. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning. It's great to be with you again.
Thank you. When you're not on the show, I miss you.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Yes, yes. Say, let's talk a little bit about the Donald Trump's picks for judges. He keeps filling the benches with conservative judges, doesn't he?
He does. This is one of the areas where you have seen a really dedicated effort on the part of the White House and conservative groups here in Washington, D.C. to work together and make sure that these 160-some vacancies have quality conservative judges nominated for them. The problem is that the Senate, because of a combination of Democrat obstructionism and just it seems like a lack of working, shall we say,
yeah,
has a backlog that stretches into the double digits. They've confirmed a total of 7 judges this year. That includes Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, of course. But there is quite a backlog, close to 60, that are waiting for confirmation. And there's no end in sight, really. There's 160 vacancies, so this could be a 4-year project on the part of Donald Trump.
Rob, how could that affect the landscape of our country with that many possibly conservative judges?
Well, it'll have a significant effect because these judges are going into positions either at federal district courts or appellate courts or possibly even the Supreme Court if there's another vacancy. And these are lifetime appointments. So when a president nominates a judge, they can serve for life. in these roles, and all that's required is that they win confirmation by the Senate. And as we remember, the Democrats in 2013 changed the rules to allow for just a simple majority vote to confirm a nominee for a federal judge or for a cabinet position like Secretary of State and whatnot. Now, the challenge is that the Democrats realize what that potential generational impact is going to be if you put all of these conservative judges into these positions, and they have required every one of these judges not only to be subjected to, in some cases, pretty brutal confirmation hearings before the Judiciary Committee, but they've also required them to the Senate to spend 30 hours debating each nominee. And while those 30 hours you do that a couple times a week, and you quickly fill up the entire week that the Senate is in session, and they're able to maybe get one or two nominees done every week.
Wow, I didn't know that was some of the hoops you had to jump through.
Well, it's traditionally not been.
Okay.
This is a new thing that's happened in 2017. Republicans did not employ this tactic. A lot of these nominees end up winning confirmation votes well above the 51 that's needed. Like, for instance, Calista Gingrich, who's not a judicial nominee, but mm-hmm. she's a nominee for the Vatican to serve as ambassador to the Vatican, and she had her confirmation vote before the Senate yesterday and won something like 70 votes. The Democrats still required her to go through this 30-hour process, and it's just another tactic that they're using to obstruct in Washington. You and I have talked about the lack of bipartisanship before.
Mm-hmm.
This is a classic case of how partisan rancor in Washington has really slowed up how things are normally done in Congress.
And it is a big deal if you're picked to be a judge, and if that is for life, because you can live a long time. I've been hearing about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's exercise regimen, and she's got like she's got like a personal trainer.
She certainly does. I mean, she is somebody who has been long rumored to either be on the verge of retirement or being sick or ill, and yet she continues to serve. And I think that we've seen this before with particularly Supreme Court judges, justices who it takes a significant act to get them to retire. Now, yes, some have. David Souter a few mm-hmm. years ago gave up his seat at a relatively young age, and a few years earlier Sandra Day O'Connor, when her husband was ill, decided to retire, although I've read that she often regrets that decision. So I think that if you are in this lifetime appointment, you probably prefer to stay in that until you're either unable to serve or perhaps you die in office.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in retrospect, should have stepped down when President Obama was in office?
Well, so when you have a liberal judge, yes, you tend to find that the conservative judges, justices, retire during a Republican president. Same goes for the liberal judges under a Democrat, because then they may have a little bit more say in who replaces them. You remember the fight that we had last year when Antonin Scalia passed away unexpectedly, and you were going to have President Obama nominating a liberal to mm-hmm. replace a conservative. It would have really significantly shifted the balance of power on the court. And in this case, possibly, but I think she also, from everything I can tell, intends to be there at least until 2021, when maybe she'll have somebody else in the White House. Who knows? But you're right. If Trump does serve 8 years, I think he has an opportunity not only to reshift the entire judicial landscape, but the Supreme Court in particular.
I'm sure the left were planning on certain things with the inevitable outcome of Hillary being in office.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. I think even some Republican senators, I mean, Mitch McConnell, when he delayed and refused to give Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court, a hearing or a vote, I think that there was even some speculation that, you know, if Hillary wins, he could use this as a bargaining chip or something. And, of course, she didn't, and the Democrats lost that opportunity. And whether you're sitting on the Supreme Court, or whether you were anticipating things to move legislatively with Hillary Clinton in office, for certain, the Democrats are in a much different position today than they would be had Hillary. And that's one of the things, as Republicans and conservatives maybe sometimes get frustrated with President Trump. One of the things that I've heard Newt Gingrich say is, just think about what Hillary Clinton would be doing in the White House were she president today.
Yeah. Speaking of Mitch McConnell, what do you think about he and the president being cozy again? And by the way, every time I hear Mitch McConnell talk, I think to myself, I bet he could do a great Jimmy Stewart impression.
I'm sure. Well, look, this is a contentious relationship. It seemed to be on the mend yesterday. The two had lunch at the White House. They came out and did a joint press conference afterward. Mitch McConnell is under a lot of fire. The conservative activists are not happy with Mitch McConnell for a number of reasons. We just talked about one of them, the slow progress on judges and mm-hmm. other nominations. The other is that they failed to repeal Obamacare. This was a 7-year promise. McConnell came up one vote short in the Senate. And, obviously he personally is in favor of repealing Obamacare. He could not get his Republican caucus together to do it, and that's caused some frustration between McConnell and the White House. So I don't know whether yesterday was just an opportunity to put on a good face before the public, and if the tension remains, I suspect that's probably the case. But there's no doubt that if they're going to get tax reform done, which is the next legislative priority for the White House, Trump and McConnell are going to need to work together.
Mm-hmm. Rob, let me take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about the Iran nuke deal, because there's nothing quite like the Iran nuke deal conversation over breakfast. So let's take a break. Be back more with Rob Bluey in just a minute. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Welcome back to the show. It's 19 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Rob Bluey. I love Rob Bluey from Washington, D.C. He's my correspondent. Rob, the president announced Friday that the U.S. would not recertify the Iran nuclear deal. Do explain.
Yes. So the Iran nuclear deal was an agreement that President Obama worked with other international partners across the globe to put in place, kind of one of those things that Obama viewed as one of his legacy items, in hoping to keep Iran from acquiring or at least advancing in the nuclear space. Iran is the biggest state sponsor of terrorism in the world, and President Trump, certainly when he was campaigning, made this a signature issue. He's routinely called it, even in the White House, one of the worst deals ever negotiated on the part of the United States. And so it didn't come as much surprise when this period expires every 90 days where the president needs to either certify or decertify the deal, that President Trump at this juncture decided to decertify the deal. Now, this really kicks it back to Congress. Congress will have a role here, and it's up to Congress to really decide now whether it's going to impose sanctions or take other actions against Iran. And for President Trump, I think one of the things that he's looking to do is, obviously he has some of these hotspots across the globe, North Korea being another one that you and I have talked about, mm-hmm. and he is trying to prevent Iran from advancing down this road. Obviously, Iran is located in a pretty strategic position within striking distance of Israel and might even have missiles that could reach Europe. So this is a serious situation.
Well, Robin, we talk about the nuclear program. It extends beyond just a nuclear weapon, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, no, certainly. I mean, this is this has the potential to extract any number of dangerous situations, in the Middle East and then even farther, mm-hmm. as I mentioned with Europe. So
yeah.
Iran is Iran has been overshadowed in some respects by the North Korea threat. As we've talked about before, North Korea and its leader Kim Jong-un, tend to love the headlines, it seems. There's no shortage of times where, as Trump calls him now, Little Rocket Man is trying to capture the world's attention with either his boisterous threats or these rocket launches. Well, Iran, in some cases, is just as dangerous, yet they're doing things perhaps a little bit more quietly. And I think the thing about the Iran deal that was so concerning, at least to those of us who were, you know, took a close look at it, was that it really it released a windfall of financial resources to the Iranian government, which kind of was an upfront payment. You know, I don't know if you remember this whole thing about the cash on the plane and
pallets of cash.
That's right, pallets of cash. And so we've gone. You know, we're not going to get that back. But I think that at this point, President Trump and Congress need to decide what can we do.
Have we asked for that money back? Hey, you want to give us that money back? Sometimes you just have to ask, Rob.
Well, I like to try, but I doubt that that plane's coming anywhere back to the United States or Europe.
Oh, that was such an odd transaction, and there was not. The president kept saying it was not based on hostage release, but the plane with the hostages and the cash plane, they took off and landed about a half hour apart from each other.
Exactly. And, of course, the United States has a long, long-standing position of not engaging in that kind of behavior, which I think shocked a lot of Americans when they saw the optics of that.
Do you trust anything Iran says?
No. I mean, I don't think your listeners should. I mean, this is not a government. Jim Phillips, who's an expert on this for the Heritage Foundation, you know, who's been watching the Middle East for over 30 years, you know, is somebody who I trust and encourage your listeners to you know, check out heritage.org and work on this, because he has done exhaustive research on Iran, and yeah, they are not a government that I would trust.
Mm-hmm. Right up there with North Korea.
That's right. And you have some of these actors on the world stage right now who, you know, for all the domestic problems that we normally talk about, I mean, there is a significant number of challenges on the global front that this White House inherited from President Obama. You know, if you were to listen to Obama, you think that that things were great, and that's not the case. I think we've quickly learned that the situation is much more tenuous than he led people to believe.
So, Rob, tell me what you're doing today. That was kind of a leading question.
Oh, we have a historic day on the
horizon. That's why I asked.
For the Heritage Foundation. First of all, at lunch, I will be hosting a conversation with Scott Pruitt. He's the EPA administrator. He is doing a number of things on the environmental front. But the big headliner of the day is President Donald Trump, who's going to be speaking at a Heritage Foundation event tonight at 7:30. Again, hope your listeners will tune in. We're going to be streaming this live from heritage.org, the Daily Signal, as well as on Facebook and Twitter and all of those other digital platforms. So it's going to be a talk on tax reform, and this will be the fourth time a U.S. president has spoken to the Heritage Foundation, the first time for President Trump, and we are delighted and very excited to welcome him.
How excited are you personally?
Pretty excited. I mean, I I've seen President Trump speak before in person at events like CPAC, but to have him come and speak before your own organization is clearly quite special, and also to give a policy address on a topic that's so timely and relevant as tax reform, I think you know, will put us in the conversation that's, you know, really going to be the big legislative battle that transpires over the next few months.
Mm-hmm. Do you have good seats?
I do. I'm hosting a table tonight, so I'm fortunate in that regard. And the Daily Signal is on site. We're going to be interviewing Mick Mulvaney, the OMB director, here shortly this morning. He's giving the breakfast speech, and then, as I mentioned, Scott Pruitt, and then closing the day with Donald Trump. So a lot of great activity happening.
Yeah. Mrs. Bluey going?
She is not. She's going to stay at home with the kids. I tried to convince her, but she felt that getting the homework done and getting them to bed early was more important.
Well, Rob, I will want a report next time we speak.
Absolutely.
Have
Look
a great
forward
day.
To it.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Yep. As Rob Bluey, my Washington, D.C. correspondent, editor of the Daily Signal and the Heritage Foundation, we'll take a little break. We're going to go for Lighten Up with Ken Davis. And then at about 22, Dr. Peter Kapsner is going to be rambling into the studio. Be back in a minute.
Just one look at you. And I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
Good morning. It is 30 minutes after the hour. We'll take a little break for news, and then Dr. Peter Kapsner will be with us. Be back in a minute. Good morning. It's 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. Peter Kapsner just walked into the studio, sipping his coffee. And before we get to him, let's hear from Lee Strobel. Lee says that people come to Christ with both an intellectual understanding of who Jesus is, as well as an experience with him. Let's hear what Lee has to say about this.
How does God personally encounter us? How does he change us? How does he transform us? I think that's a necessary but not sufficient kind of evidence. In other words, I think it's necessary because if God exists, you would think he would change our lives. But it's not sufficient in and of itself because other religions claim life change too. So I think it's an important part of the case. It hits more of the heart than the head perhaps, but I think nevertheless it's persuasive when we look at stories that are so amazing and so just staggering how God has transformed lives. You kind of step back and you say, oh, you know, only God could do this. So I think it ultimately does point toward God as the source of this transformation.
If you want to hear that whole interview by Lee Strobel, you can head over to myfaithradio.com, type in Lee Strobel or Gift Grace, and you will get there. We'll take a very short break and then have a lively discussion with Dr. Peter Kapsner in studio.
There's no question these are troubling times to raise children, but don't give up. This is Jim Garlow. As a parent, you know children will test you to the max, but don't give up on them. There's never been a time in our history when we were in greater need of strong leaders for the future, leaders who will honor God and honor His Word. Frankly, I don't care where your kids go to college or how much money they earn. I do care that they love God. I care about how they treat other people. It should be our desire to raise convictional, rational, loving, highly principled children wherever they serve. And it starts with us as parents. If our priorities are straight, then we as parents will honor God and His Word, because that's the place to start. There's more to help you raise children with character at jimgarlow.com.
Good morning. It's 24 minutes until the top of the hour, and I have in studio Dr. Peter Kapsner.
Morning, sir.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Bright and early this morning.
You
again.
Are indeed. All right. Yeah. Let's start with what I saw. Mrs. Clinton broke her toe. She said she was running down the stairs in heels with a cup of coffee in hand, talking over her shoulder, and her heel caught, and she fell backwards. Who writes her excuses? John Lovitz?
Well,
yeah, that's a ticket. That's a ticket. I was running downstairs with coffee.
Well, and I noticed this morning walking in that the back of my sandal strap was not fitting terribly effectively. But
of course not.
I mean, there was every opportunity to wipe out on the way in here. But had that happened, I would not have had somebody that could have sort of buffeted the excuse train on that. That would have been a bummer.
In the past, we've seen her almost being spotted by two people going up steps.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. I remember that that optics of when she was walking into her vehicle and nearly fell down at that point. And
that,
it does seem like there are people around her.
Certainly
at
cutting
moment.
Her a lot of slack for that one. But just any normal flight of stairs, you kind of see spotters all the time.
Who runs
down the stairs with coffee? Who does that?
I don't have spotters, but I do often wish that I did. It's a risky maneuver. Any stair flight is risky.
Yes. And can you just come right out and say what happened? Were you really running down in heels?
Yeah, I don't know why I struggle with that. Yeah, in fairness, I can authentically say that I have never run down the stairs in heels before.
Well,
and so I can't really walk in other people's shoes.
I don't know if I'm buying that, Peter.
Well, you know, I at least have to put on the image.
Yeah. All right, there's all kinds of cultural appropriation about Halloween costumes now. There's a college here in town, St. Thomas, saying you can't wear a costume if you don't understand or respect the culture. This can be, you know, you can't pretend to be something that has a long-standing stereotype.
Well, we're about ready to celebrate Halloween with our five kids at home, mm-hmm. and we're having to pause to make sure that we are politically correct heading out of the neighborhood,
sure.
with our sacks for the. And I don't know what's actually politically correct at all about just going to a person's house and demanding candy anyway. So
I
have to worry about what I'm wearing at the same time. It's going to get dicey.
I was traumatized as a kid because, like, I don't know, was I probably 9 or 10? I got beat up. By a group of boys, yeah.
Did they take your candy?
Well, maybe I shouldn't have gone dressed as a pinata.
My understanding is that often doesn't end well.
No, that was my dad's idea to dress up as a pinata. So anyway, all right, when people often say, I don't agree with everything they say, or I'm not perfect, don't you think we should eliminate that from our vocabulary?
Well, I think it's one of those sort of self-evident statements, is it not? It's just who is perfect in all that they say, and it feels like it's sort of this hedge that somebody doesn't want to commit to something one direction or the other, and so they end up just trying to hedge their bet. It's like when somebody comes in the room and says to be perfectly honest or to be frank. It's these weird hedges that we do that we don't want to reveal certain things about ourselves.
Uh-huh. But when we have conversations with people and they say, well, I don't agree with everything they say, I go, does that apply to anybody?
Well, it's right. I can't
think
of it.
Do you agree with everything your wife says?
No. And then we do the lovely dance of working those things out at that point.
Right.
But it just speaks to the idea of, can we just have mutual conversation without all this tension between? Of course we're not going to agree with everything, and that doesn't have to be a bad thing. That's actually, in my mind, an invitation for growth. If we're supposed to just stand around and agree with everybody, there's no growth mechanism ahead of us.
Thank you. I think that's a lot of wisdom. All right, let's talk a little bit about the Boy Scouts.
Yes. Yeah. Did you see the headlines on that one? My understanding is that there was a young girl who transitioned to a young boy. She was a boy and went to a girl but stayed
a girl.
Yes.
Now she wants to join the Boy Scouts.
So there is some gender blurring that happens there.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I was talking with some friends of ours too, and they were talking about in their school at this point that their 13-year-old son was feeling quite uncomfortable because there was in school the mandate that they had to share bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And her reflection on that was that, well, who's taking into account the comfort of my son as he's now having to share the bathroom with this person who had transitioned into a girl? And there's just, it feels like a one-way conversation about who gets the voice and who gets the comfort in this, as opposed to people that might be feeling a bit awkward about all of this. And it was interesting. I was reading this weekend and listening to a woman. She was an atheist, lesbian, liberal scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And her name is Camille Paglia. And I would have expected a certain kind of response from her around all of these issues on gender. But she made the point, and then I started looking at it historically, that you can start seeing culture unravel throughout history. And some of the last stages of a culture unraveling is when the gender lines begin to blur. So I was very surprised coming from somebody that I wouldn't normally listen to, mm-hmm. or a voice that I would even think about. And yet she was talking historically that this tends to portend the end of a culture or an unraveling of a culture. So it really is. It's a sobering thing. There's more important things going on than just Boy Scout, Girl Scout. This speaks to a much larger issue in, mm-hmm. our culture.
Did you get that quote I sent you from Theodore Dalrymple?
Can you remind me?
Yes, I will.
Yes.
It says, in the study of communist societies, I came to the conclusion that the purpose of communist propaganda was not to persuade or convince, not to inform, but to humiliate. And therefore, the less it corresponded to reality, the better. When people are forced to remain silent when they are being told the most obvious lies, or even worse, when they're forced to repeat the lies themselves, they lose once and for all their sense of probity. To assent to obvious lies is, in some small way, to become evil oneself. One standing to resist anything is thus eroded and even destroyed. A society of emasculated liars is easy to control. I think if you examine political correctness, it has the same effect and is intended to.
It does. That's a powerful quote. I think I followed 74% of it.
Well,
in terms of some of the, just in thinking about it this morning and this early, it's a powerful quote and reminds me even of the ancient Israelites in Egypt and this idea of the purest form of power, that the reason why Pharaoh decided to take out the male children in that culture It was because Pharaoh knew that if he could take out and control the carriers of the future, that over time, mm-hmm. people would just get assimilated into a way of thinking, and they would no longer have their identity of Israelites, and he could control them in that way. And there's a quote that I know. Stephen Lukes was the guy who said that the purest form of power is when you have people in your power and they don't any longer know that they're in power. They just assume this is the way of life. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the danger of this political correctness conversation, is give it a generation and everybody yeah. begins to think the same way, and they don't realize anymore that there might be other ways to think about these things. And there's the power that is described in that quote.
Well, and it says, he says, if we're forced to repeat the lies themselves, you know, we're talking last week when we had Kim Cattola here.
Yes.
And Kim was saying women don't have babies. Persons have babies because some might be men,
which is
a lie, and I can't repeat that lie.
And yet I find myself at times being affected by it as well, where I'm also mindful of my own language and thinking I've got to change the way that I say this word. And it happens very subtly, and it's not even that I necessarily agree with it, but somehow I can be in places where I think I'm having respectful conversation and I need to say it this way out of respect. But over time, I realize that my language begins to shift in some very subtle ways, and I'm very uncomfortable with words I would have been very comfortable with 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it happens so subtly and so quickly.
Yeah. We'll take a little break. We've got Dr. Peter Kapsner in studio with us having a lively conversation. It is 15 minutes until the top of the hour. So glad you're with us. I just like letting that song go. Let's go fish.
I love that.
I know.
My kids were actually at the Imagine Dragons concert last night.
Oh, wow.
And I fell asleep well before they got home, and I'm sort of curious how that was for them. We got photos.
How old are your kids?
They're 17 and 15.
Okay.
And yeah. My daughter wore eyeliner last night for the first time.
Really?
I let her do that, but then
you
my son
her
was her
house.
Bouncer, and,
okay,
and
good.
So it worked out okay.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. There's all kinds of, I don't know if we call it new news, but Willow Creek decided they're going to forge ahead after Pastor Bill Hybels by choosing co-ed pastors. So maybe we can have a conversation about how the scholars feel about this.
Yeah.
I'd like to bring light to the subject and not just heat.
Yeah, because there's going to be quite a bit of heat with this subject, I would think. A lot of response is going to be coming. I had sent that article to a friend of mine that I wasn't sure if he had even seen it yet, but sure enough, he had. And I have a feeling there's going to be some buzz about this conversation. And it's an important one. We talk about it in my classes quite often, especially when I was teaching a leadership class in church leadership. And women in ministry was one of the primary topics we had to cover in class. It was part mm-hmm. of the prescribed curriculum. And what I really appreciated about getting into that was this idea that you can bring in two or three or four really well-regarded, well-respected biblical scholars in this world, and they will look at these passages in Paul and look at some of the witness of the biblical text and come to the conclusion that women should not be in a place of leadership in the church. And then if they left the room and you brought in three or four more well-respected conservative biblical scholars looking at these same texts, that they would see things differently in those texts. And they're not saying we need to throw out the Bible. They're actually saying, no, the Bible, rightly understood, does allow for women in ministry. And it's just a fascinating conversation in class back and forth with this topic. One of the, just in sort of the minutia of that, is in that Timothy passage where it says, where Paul says, I don't permit women to teach or have authority over men. And some of the fun that we get into in class is that the word in the Greek language there for authority is not the word exousia, which means typically like an office of authority. It's this Greek word authentine, which nobody really knows for sure what that word means. And it just gets really fun to get into the text to try to understand what was Paul getting at. Was he prohibiting women from leadership, generally speaking, or was there something going on in the Ephesian church mm-hmm. that he was talking about specifically? And it's just a really interesting conversation, very lively in class. And it's almost impossible to have the conversation without some degree of heat because of our backgrounds, because of what we believe to be true. But if we can just simply start by talking about the different ideas, then we can sort of go from there.
Yeah, you're doing it very calmly, by the way.
Am
Thank
I?
You.
Well,
yes.
I said a few years of practice.
Okay, now what about the difference between church leadership and then being in the pulpit?
Well, that becomes the question. And so much of it is around the teaching piece of this, that women shouldn't be teaching. And so if we go into those topics, and I've been in environments and seen environments where even a female student might be giving a presentation and some of the male students in the room will turn their chairs because of their belief that they shouldn't be taught in any way, shape, or form by a female. And yet other people would say, no, absolutely, the female has gifts to be teaching in this class. And so that really gets to be what you talked about. The fulcrum of the issue is whether women should be teaching. And I've seen it play itself out both ways. And it's a really interesting conversation.
And it will continue to be a hot topic, won't it?
I would love for this to just be a mutual exploration of possibility, but it just hardly ever is that. Yeah. There's something about this kind of conversation that is almost always filled with tension.
And of course, the world's first evangelist was a woman. Mary leaving the tomb.
Absolutely.
When Jesus said, go tell the others.
Yeah, it's part of the fun when I have some of the scholars that I know that would speak into this when they talked about how the women at the tomb were the first witnesses and that they went and spoke to the male apostles about what they had seen. And that would have been really countercultural at that point because women in Jesus's time were not even trusted to testify in a court of law because they were seen to be inherently unreliable.
Right.
So to entrust these women with the best news where the universe got tipped upside down with the tomb was a really big deal that they entrusted. I would have liked to have been in the room with all those men when the women came into the room and said, here is the good news that we just heard, just trying for them to sort all of this sort of stuff out. I'm sure it was hot in that room as well.
Yeah. I'm going to take this up further with Dr. Mark Muska. Mark Muska. You know Mark Muska, don't you?
Oh, I know the name.
He's a professor here at University of Northwestern.
Right.
He is in Lebanon right now, and they call him Mark over there. I don't know why.
Well, it's funny, even teaching a school where there's divergent views in school, and I think sometimes we struggle talking about these things, and nobody really wants to bring them to the surface. And so it's an important conversation. I'm glad you're having him on.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't know it yet.
Well, we'll pray.
He will
we'll
be
pray
on.
Him into it. Yes.
He will
yes,
be on.
No, we know these things, and it's fine. We'll
yes,
get him through.
Yes. I've got ways to influence him. All right, let's talk about what's headlines in the news, which continues to be the Harvey Weinstein saga.
Yeah, gosh.
And now he's headed off to rehab. Will he accomplish anything in rehab?
Well, I think rehab and those kinds of contexts really do have their place. And I've seen change happen in people's lives. But I think absent of doing rehab within Jesus's kingdom and having our Savior there along the way with us, I'm skeptical about the fullness of any kind of rehabilitation that can happen absent of our Christian faith.
It is interesting what's happening, though, what's coming out of the woodwork. It seems like Hollywood's certainly going to, you know, they're trying to position themselves as the moral conscience by all of the everything they talk about. And I think the Oscars awards will be 2 hours shorter without people thinking Harvey Weinstein. That's one advantage.
Absolutely, because that's already at about 6.5 hours, the last I saw.
Yeah.
But I do think it's been an interesting move because all the messaging coming from Hollywood has been sort of this moral outrage. And yet at the same time, there's also this, but it's going on all over the place. We're finally glad it came to the surface. And so you can't really have both the moral outrage when there's this suspicion or suggestion that also everybody's participating in it. It's a really interesting circular situation Hollywood has found itself in.
Now, do your students have an interest in this story?
You know, I'm always curious what's trending in their minds because this seems so clear that this would be in the forefront. But there have been so many times where I've brought up a headline like this and they'll say, who? They haven't heard of this. So I'll be curious when we start talking about this in class. Are they aware of this particular conversation? I'm not in their Facebook communities and Twitter accounts, so I don't really know what's trending among them. But I'm always surprised when it's not some of these kind of headlines.
I just hope it brings a little bit of a change in the conversation in Hollywood because it'd be nice if the pendulum would swing back a little bit to more family-friendly movies and stories that are more edifying. And I mean, I kind of stopped going to movies.
It is tricky, isn't it?
Do you go to movies?
I mean, I do, but especially when I take my kids, I will tend to screen almost anything.
Yeah.
You know, not because I'm trying to protect them completely, but just so that they don't get hit unawares with something that I'm not prepared to talk with them about. And so kids know that they say, Dad, can I see this movie? And I'll try to at least check it out on that level for them. I mean, we took a big risk last night. We were at a friend's house, and they hadn't seen the movie Sing. And so I let them watch it without me screening it. But I'm amazed sometimes, even in these animated shows, the subtleties of what's presented and portrayed. And it goes back to our previous conversation where you kind of, over time, you just stuff gets normalized and things shift in your mind, and it happens really quickly through some of the portrayals and movies that take shape.
Yeah. Well, Peter, always a delight to have you in the studio. Thanks so much for coming by this morning, and I look forward to our conversation next week.
Sounds
good. Same time, same bat channel, Dr. Peter Kapsner. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. It is 3 minutes until the top of the hour. That wraps up hour one of the show. So glad you joined us this morning. A special hello to all of our friends that are listening this morning. 94.1 in Hartford, especially some of the new signals, 93.1 in Waterloo. And in Madison at 104.7. Good morning, our friends in Madison. 90.7 FM and 97.5 here right in the Twin Cities. We've got Dr. David Stevens coming up in the next hour, as well as Dr. Glenn Pickering is going to be with us in studio. We're going to talk a little bit more about the game of tag and when it's happening at work, what can you do about it? It's going to be a fascinating conversation with Dr. Glenn Pickering and Dr. David Stevens. Lots of doctors in hour two. Doctors in hour one, too. It's with the doctors. Be back in a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.